everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. Hope you're doing well today. Enjoying October. We've made it to October here in New York. The leaves are turning colors. Gary and I were able to go out for a long drive and see all the beauty in nature and breathe the fresh autumn air. There are lots of things that we can appreciate and be grateful for while the rest of the world around us seems to be going nuts. But let's get back to nuts and other food, my favorite subject. I'm looking forward to today's program. We have some really wonderful guests. To begin with, I'm going to be bringing on Nava Atlas. She has a new cookbook out called Vegan on a Budget. Her first cookbook. Will you believe this? You won't believe this. Her first cookbook came out in 1984. She has been writing one wonderful cookbook after the next, vegetarian and now vegan, and they're fabulous. So we'll have a brief moment with her, and then I'm going to be talking with Marisa Miller-Wolfson and Laura Delhauer, who have a new book out called The Vegetated Family Table. And this is an excellent book for people who are expecting little people in their lives, babies that grow into toddlers that grow into children. The book has great recipes, and it's filled with helpful and delicious tips for growing children. But first, let's get back to Nava Atlas. Nava Atlas is the author of best-selling vegetarian and vegan cookbooks, including Wild About Greens, Vegan Holiday Kitchen, Vegan Soups, and Hearty Stews for All Seasons, and so many others. Nava also creates visual books on women's issues and runs two websites, The Vegan Atlas and Literary Ladies Guide. She lives in the Hudson Valley region of New York. I'm bringing her on for a brief moment to talk about her newest cookbook, Vegan on a Budget, 125 healthy, wallet-friendly plant-based recipes. Hi, Nava.
How are you today?
Good. Is this your 14th cookbook?
Something like that. You know, I really have lost track because I also have a few books that were revised and updated. So I don't know whether to count those or not. So let's say 14th-ish, 15th-ish.
Yeah, well, I opened the book and I saw the list. I've got five of them now. And I was just amazed that there were so many. And I wondered, I had a lot of questions like, how do you do that? You put out so many cookbooks. And then I wondered, since you don't seem to be counting, I wondered if you had like a goal. I'm going to put out 25 cookbooks or something like that.
At this point in my life, probably not. And I do write other types of books. But, you know, interestingly, and the reason I do revised editions is, as you know, food trends change so much. There's new ingredients all the time, and the way we think about food changes all the time. And, you know, about, I don't know, 8 years or so, suddenly everybody fell in love with leafy greens. And I think we kind of met in New York City right around that time that I was working on it, because I remember you are a big fan of green smoothies.
Yes.
And green juices.
Green everything. Well, I think it's part of what saved my life, but yeah.
Absolutely. So there's that. And now there's the book that's coming out in December, which will be my 15th or 16th, who's counting, will be about the plant-based meat alternatives. And the reason I decided to do that, even though that's not a huge part of my own diet, I feel like it will be a great bridge for people who are exploring a plant-based diet and to prove that you don't have to give up anything anymore. And it's especially important now with climate change. You know, we've got to get away from this animal-based food subsystem that we
have. Yes. Yeah, we do.
It'll be a way that I really think that will help people do that.
How long have you been vegan?
Let's see. My son was 10. He's now 28. That's how I count. So we just passed 18 years vegan, but before that, decades as a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Vegan had not been quite invented yet.
Exactly. You talk about trends changing and that it's part of your motivation for writing more cookbooks. Have these trends affected the way you eat?
Yes, I would say definitely, because I feel like I'm a beneficiary of the broader array of foods out there. Everybody is. I mean, when you think about it, I think when I became a vegetarian, I had to get my special foods from this dusty little health food store in suburban Detroit. Now, you know, you go into almost any supermarket and you could get your oat milk and a lot of bulk foods and much wider array of fruits and vegetables. So yeah, I feel like it's just getting better and better all the time.
Definitely getting better. Anything other than greens that sticks out that you've changed, like something you used to eat a lot that you thought was healthy and don't eat now, or something that you discovered was healthy that you weren't eating that you're eating more of?
Well, it's interesting because I'm in the midst of updating my very first book, Vegetariana, which was published in 1984. And it's almost like a cookbook slash art project. And I've had to do some drawings and I've been working on that. It's been a really good COVID project because the drawings are really time consuming. I was really struck by the much more limited array of ingredients. Now, I don't even know if I used quinoa in that book, for example. Yeah. I don't think quinoa was available in 1984. Yeah, it's really so mainstream now. One thing that I remember was, you know, now we have baked tofu. You can just buy it in the package and all I do really is smoosh it and put vegan mayo and celery and a little nutritional yeast and it's your basic chicken or tuna substitute and so much better. But back then we'd have to take regular tofu, put it in the freezer, then take it out and squeeze out all the water. And that was more of like our crumbled tofu type of thing. I'm just the array of ingredients. And of course, it's always a matter of quantity and how much somebody can fly and manufacture, then the prices come down. And so that's, you know, what everybody's hoping for with the plant-based meat alternatives, because they still are a bit pricey for people who want to use them.
And that brings us to Vegan on a Budget. So you put together lots and lots of recipes and they all look so cozy and familiar.
I think that that's been my approach with almost all of my books. I really don't go for the exotic. I live in a town, which is a really very lovely town. And in fact, it was written up in the New York Times this past week. And now I'm afraid everybody's going to move here. So we basically have two supermarkets and a nice but smallish natural food store. So I feel like I don't have access to international groceries or maybe the more exotic ingredients that people can access in cities. But in a way, I feel like that sort of keeps the books real. It really focuses on ingredients that anyone can get pretty much at the supermarket.
I'm a big soup lover.
Oh, me too. I mean, I've written a whole book about soups too, and I feel like it's almost time to update that one too.
I don't know why other people don't love soup as much as I do. I know some people do, or some people like soup better in the cooler weather. It's starting to get cool now, and I'm thinking, yeah, bring my soups back. But I just find them very easy, and they're full of variety. It's funny too, because I'm the kind of person who likes to separate all the food that I eat. I eat one thing at a time, one dish at a time.
Okay.
But I like soup, which has all the ingredients all mixed together. But still, if I had soup and some other things on the plate, I would eat my soup first, one dish at a time. But I just love soup. And the one I'm going to try, which I'm surprised I have yet to make, is the tortilla soup.
Yeah, that's a fun soup.
I'm really into making my own corn tortillas now.
Oh, that's impressive.
Well, it came out of the coronavirus where we started making more of the processed foods or the prepared foods that we buy. And we don't buy very processed foods, but we would buy tortillas and things like ketchup and yogurt and things like that. And I just started making them at home. Okay. They take a little time. And I know most people aren't going to jump into that kind of thing, but I love making them. We buy organic masa harina. I got the press and now I just have fresh tortillas. So now I just got to take some of them and cut them up in little strips. And
I bet fresh tortillas are much better than the kind you buy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything is.
People don't believe me because I've written so many books. I'm pretty lazy, but I also started to do a little bit more DIY. Before the weather got really too warm, I made kimchi and I was kind of surprised by how easy it is. That's an item that's pretty expensive. And I really liked having the control over it because you can also control how spicy it is.
Yeah.
It's so good for the system. So I'm going to start making that again. And a friend of mine just sent me some dehydrated sourdough starter. And I've
Ooh.
Not done that. And I'm a little intimidated, but I really want to learn how to do that because I'm not a big bread eater or a bread fan, but I do like sourdough.
Mm-hmm.
I think this, you know, if there's any blessing to this, which I don't really think there are too many blessings, it is maybe making people more self-sufficient.
Exactly. Yeah. I bought a few pickling tops for my ball jars so that I can make some pickles. And I make sauerkraut, but it's better with the right tools.
Yeah. I make refrigerator pickles. I love that. That's mm-hmm. something. And I have that in the book, actually. So easy. And it's in 24 hours, you have really delicious pickles and you don't need any special canning equipment for that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's on the list. We'll do that. Yeah. Anything you want to tell me specifically about this cookbook, how it's different from other ones you've done?
Basically, it's the focus on maybe, I don't know if the word is frugality, but you know, being mindful of a budget. And, you know, I always preface this by saying that this is really not about the issue of food insecurity, which is really very serious. And it's another topic altogether. I feel like, you know, this is for people who are lucky enough to have, you know, good markets near them still, but do want to save money on food. One of the discoveries that I made after the book was published is the things like Misfits Market, where you get the produce that's not pretty enough to go into the store. So that's sort of an addendum to the book. So that's something also that's convenient now where people don't want to go into the store that often. It definitely saves money. It saves time. Food waste is a huge issue in this country. And what I really liked finding out about Misfits Market is they employ the formerly incarcerated and people who are also addicts. So it's sort of like giving them a second chance. So I like that. One of the things I wanted to talk about is busting a couple of myths. Now, we always hear about supermarket shopping that we should only shop the periphery, which I think is just the silliest myth ever. Because if you're going to only shop the periphery, you're going to miss out on pasta and beans, dried beans or canned beans, whatever you want, the spices, the condiments. So, and also another tip I learned by researching this book is that you need to look on bottom shelves at supermarkets because suppliers actually pay for eye-level shelves.
Wow.
A lot of the bargain foods are down below. So you just got to look. One of my favorite kind of practical yet lazy tips is to really explore the prepared condiments. Now, when you think of condiments as being something fancy or expensive, it's really not true. And one of the things I've really fallen in love with is Indian simmer sauces.
Mm.
Have you tried those?
I have not, but maybe I should.
They are really delicious. They really make whatever you pour them into taste like it came from the best Indian restaurant.
Wow. Is there a brand?
There's a couple of brands. One of them is Maya Kamal, which is really more of the natural food store brand. And they're a local company to where I live in the Hudson Valley. So that's nice too. And then there's, I think it's P-A-T-A-K, Pataks. But I understand that Trader Joe's makes some really decent simmer mm-hmm. sauces. One caveat is that some of them have dairy. So if people don't use dairy, they have
read the labels.
But there are plenty of vegan varieties. Jalfrezi, another one is called Rohan Josh. And they are absolutely delicious. They're also a really good soup starter. Let's say you were making a red lentil soup. If you pour one of these into it, I call it a flavor bomb. It's just
yeah, so right good. Away it transports you to another world.
It does. Yeah. And, you know, and doing takeout Indian food, it's a nice treat once in a while. But I think it was while I was starting this book, we hadn't done it for a while, my family of four. And I was really kind of shocked because it was almost $70 and it wasn't a lot of food. Even with getting the sauce, which let's say it's between $4 or $5 a jar. But when you pour it into, let's say, a pan of chickpeas and cauliflower, and you just make or get a flatbread, it really makes for a very economical meal. And it really tastes like it came from my favorite Indian restaurant.
Yeah. And it's probably better for you too, because you know what's in it. You know
right.
what's in the sauce, and you right. know what's in the food that you've prepared. When you go to a restaurant, sometimes it's a leap of faith. Some are better than others.
You know, and in that same category, there would be peanut sauce. So let's say if you wanted to make a Thai dish, and usually the peanut sauce has all kinds of things like tamarind and lemongrass and things that either are pricey or that really are not available at your local supermarket. So right there. So it's really a lot more economical than one would think.
Great tips, Nava. I love seeing you, and
Great to see you too.
I hope sometime when the world settles into the new normal, whatever that's going to be, we can meet and we can hug and
Oh, that would be wonderful.
we can have a
Lots
meal.
of hugs.
Such crazy times, and every day the news gets wilder and wilder.
It really does. That day will come. It could be a while.
And in the meantime, you're just going to keep putting out great books.
Thank you. I will try.
Vegan on a Budget, 125 healthy, wallet-friendly, plant-based recipes by the one and only Nava Atlas.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, take care. Stay
Bye.
well. Be
You
safe.
too.
Moving on. Next up, we have Marisa Miller Wolfson, who is a mother of two and the creator of the award-winning documentary Vegucated. And Laura Delhauer, a plant-based culinary artist and environmental rights activist. They are co-authors of The Vegucated Family Table, Irresistible Vegan Recipes and Proven Tips for Feeding Plant-Powered Babies, Toddlers, and Kids. Laura, you're in California. Marisa, you're in New York.
Yes.
And
Yeah.
we're Zooming together. How are you doing?
Doing great, doing great.
Yes, doing much better than many right now. So I'm just very grateful for that.
Yes, this is a time for gratitude. I talk
Yes.
about that a lot because we're learning. Some of us have been more comfortable than others for a long time, some of us not. But we're all starting to feel that uncertainty, that discomfort, whether it's with our government or the environment. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on. Breathing, everybody breathing.
Yes.
Breathing is such an important thing. And going within sometimes, thinking about all the good that we have. I just want to mention, we started this interview a little later than expected, which is totally fine. That gave me the opportunity to make a pie crust.
Nice.
That's always good.
Yes. I've been in pie mode this week too. Do you do a special pie crust?
Yeah, my listeners know I'm kind of obsessed right now with making my own flour, and I
Wow.
make mostly gluten-free things. So I'm really into grinding up whatever whole grain I have. I have one of these Vitamix grain mixers, so I grind either oat groats, steel cut oats, or rolled oats, or millet, or sorghum, and sometimes garbanzo beans, and I mix them up together, or I use one or the other, depending on what I have. And I make a flour with them, and I'm having a lot of fun with that.
That's so great. I actually just started the gluten-free baking course with the Gluten-Free Baking Academy.
Nice.
And I'm so happy because I've wanted to make my own bread and things for a long time, but I'm not a big white flour girl.
Yeah.
I don't like using it. And the idea, I've been using a lot of in my baking with like cakes and different things like that over the years. I've incorporated a lot of oat flour, coconut flour, almond flour, things like the hazelnut flour. But I knew there was more, and I'd heard such good things about it for so long. And I literally just started it 2 days ago.
Good
So
for
I'm
you.
so excited about that. Yeah.
Well, a lot of us are always talking about the arc of veganism and how it gets easier and easier because there are so many more products and we're learning.
Yeah.
So we can still use a lot of whole foods and make things that we never knew we could make before. And then there are all the extra foods. And the same thing with gluten-free baking. They've both evolved so wonderfully.
So true. I think for a long time, people thought that gluten-free, especially gluten-free and vegan, meant
Yeah.
that it tasted like cardboard. And gluten-free vegan, some of my gluten-free vegan recipes are my favorite recipes
Yeah.
and my loved ones' favorite recipes, whether they're vegan or not, favorite to eat anyway. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if you follow Great British Baking Show, but there was, for the first episode of this season, there was a gluten-free baker, a primarily gluten-free baker,
Yes.
who nailed it, and he ended up being
Star
the,
Baker.
yeah, exactly.
Yes. Well, it's all about getting out of these conventions that somehow we adapted over, I don't know, last 50 years, last 100 years, that we're only supposed to use wheat and we're only supposed to do it this way and it has to have this and that. And we really kind of limited ourselves. And what I love about being vegan is every time I don't want to use the word restrict, but every time I eliminate foods, my world expands.
It's so true. Yeah. So true.
So here we are. We're all so evolved. And we're making wonderful things. And now we want to talk about the Veggiecated family table. Irresistible vegan recipes and proven tips for feeding plant-powered babies, toddlers, and kids. I'm very happy to see this book because it's so needed. But I have to add that you probably should have added here plant-powered babies, toddlers, kids, and adults who want to eat like kids, or just adults.
Because totally true. I don't have any children and I co-wrote the book and I eat all of these foods.
Of course, there are plenty
of baby food recipes, but everything else.
Yeah. Well, even the baby food recipes, they're just purees.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Certainly. But I actually really enjoy like the cashew creamed kale. Is that what we call it in the book, Marisa?
Yeah.
Okay. That's one of my favorite things. I make that for myself regularly.
It's great on toast. It's so good on toast.
It's great. It's great as a side dish. Yeah, on toast, it's great.
There's almond beans and cream. I make that for my dad. It's sort of like got the comfort, familiar aspect of a green bean casserole, but it's with an almond cream sauce. And my dad loved it. I tried all these recipes out on my family and, you know, they're totally accepted and beloved by them as well.
I want to start at the beginning with the foreword that you got done by Genesis Butler, who's now 13, 14?
She's just turned 13 this summer, yeah.
If you haven't heard about Genesis Butler, please Google about her because she's amazing. And one of these, I don't know, she's an old soul or something. She was just really young and just knew everything.
Yeah. I mean, she's the youngest TEDx speaker, I think, that there was at the time. At age 6, she did a TEDx talk on being a vegan kid. That's unbelievable. I mean, how many kids have the wherewithal at 6 to challenge a carnist way of eating and then to have the sort of poise and confidence and talent to be able to pull off a TED talk about it? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I was introduced to Genesis's work a few years ago, and I saw her, it was a compilation of a bunch of activists giving speeches and doing interviews. It was like kind of a little documentary thing. And I remember initially thinking that I had mixed feelings about the idea of what I perceived was what was going on, which was the idea of parents throwing children into activism at a very young age.
Right.
And so that was my initial feeling about her, was like, oh, you know, like, I mean, obviously, and Marisa talks really beautifully about when parents raise their children vegan, it's not a matter of like pushing your beliefs on a child any more than a carnist family pushing their beliefs on a child. But the idea of activism felt like a lot to me. And I was like, oh, that's a, you know, an intense thing to push a kid into. And then I found out absolutely not. This was 100, she made her family go vegan, not made, but she was the inspiration for her family to go vegan. She chose to go vegan on her own as a child. And that was so exciting to me. And she's very inspirational.
Well, and she comes, I think part of sort of her underlying principles come from being the grandniece, or is it great niece? I don't even know, of Cesar Chavez. I mean,
amazing.
To have that kind of, you know, legacy in your family and to come from that activist tradition. And also to know through his experience that you are going to confront a lot of defensive people and might even get threats like he did. And she talks about that too, where, you know, when she feels bad or she feels scared or whatever, she just thinks about all the challenges and all the threats and so forth that he was under, and then just gains a bit of confidence from that and perspective from that.
But she didn't really know who he was at 6 years old when she had her own epiphany.
No, she didn't. But I think that might have informed her stance and her activism and her confidence around, you know, speaking her truth.
So, excellent way to open the book.
Thank you.
You've got, it's like your story of raising your children, Marisa, and along with it, we have dietitian advice from Reed Mengel, PhD, amazing. She's been around for a long time, leading and guiding us and telling the American Dietetic Association that vegan diets can be healthy. It was really nice to have that credibility in there as well.
Yeah, I wanted that. She was the author of the Everything Vegan Pregnancy book, which was my Bible when I was pregnant. My nutritional Bible was my go-to book. And she had co-written a lot of books that, you know, were foundational to me when I was beginning my journey into veganism. And so it was really a no-brainer to want her on board, but to actually get her on board felt like a real coup. It felt like a real coup. And she's so professional and delightful to work with.
So great to work with.
Yeah, such a pleasure. And I'm so grateful to her.
Okay, now let's get to the meat of this book, which is the recipes.
Which have no meat.
Of course, which have no animal. Hooray. And I just picked out a few that I want to talk about. The first one is the baby mac-o-lantern and cheese. Laura, yes. That's your recipe, right? So you use pumpkin puree for this cheesy sauce, which is a great idea. I've seen different orangey vegetables used from time to time, like butternut squash. And they're wonderful in these dishes. Not only do they give that nice cheddar color, but they have a light sweetness to them.
There was another recipe, like a cheesy orzo recipe that had pumpkin puree in it that Marisa and I had messed around in the kitchen with for a while, that was like an older family favorite of theirs. And then when we were like, we definitely want to have a mac and cheese recipe in the book, I was like, that works really well, but I think we could tweak it to taste more like mac and cheese. And that's the big thing, right? Because so many vegan mac and cheese recipes, to me, they taste more like a pasta Alfredo, which is beautiful. And mm-hmm. I love that, but they don't taste like mac and cheese to me. So that was a goal of ours, was to have something that really tasted like mac and cheese. And I really like working with the orzo because it adds this thickness to the recipe, like making a risotto. But we also have the option later in the book, because that's actually in the baby food section, but I eat it for dinner regularly.
Oh, of course. So do we.
Yeah, but you can make it if you want. Marisa tweaked that recipe to be just a sauce that you could pour over any kind of pasta. You could put it over macaroni or anything like that. And that recipe is in our Sneaky Sauces, Spreads, and Sprinkles recipe chapter, which is my favorite chapter. But yeah, the mac-o-lantern and cheese, my preference is actually to make it the way it is in the baby food section. And then the title, I remember exactly where I was standing in Marisa's kitchen when she came up with that title. And I was like, yes.
Was I on the couch? I feel like I was on the couch.
I think you were at the counter. You were sitting at the counter and I was standing in the kitchen.
So we've made, yeah, a lot of memories in that kitchen, a lot of memories. And yeah. And what was super fulfilling and satisfying and gratifying was when we were in California doing the photo shoot, and we had these little models trying out the food. And we had a little baby model. She was, about one, I'd say, or maybe 9 months. Do you remember? I don't remember.
I think she, between the two.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you don't know if a baby or a child is going to like the food. And none of our little tasters were 100% vegan. You know, I mean, some had been exposed to vegan food, but some hadn't. And we were nervous about it. Like, okay, we have to have their pictures taken enjoying the food. Will they actually enjoy it? Well, that little baby gobbled it up. And then remember how the mom said it was good, right?
Yes. Yes.
And all of our little models loved the food. And some of the things were, you know, a little bit different, like the cheesy sauce, the mac-o-lantern and cheese sauce, they put on a baked potato and with broccoli. And I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, we were like, we don't normally do that, but that's fine.
And then the kids loved it. So yeah. that was
there you go. That's a good testament. Okay, moving on. Avocado toast fingers with noosh. Now, I never buy avocado toast in restaurants. You know, it's usually like ridiculously expensive. And I don't go to restaurants anymore. I haven't been in one over 6 months.
Totally.
But I love avocado toast. Who doesn't?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was one of my son's staples when he was... Well, no, what am I talking about? He still eats that. Every week he has avocado toast in some form. But when he was, you know, just exploring finger foods for the first time, he loved that because it's just that perfect little hand shape. And, you know, babies and toddlers love anything with toast. And when actually he made it with the cashew cream sauce, which is from Drina Burton, whose recipes I adore. And we included her cashew cream sauce, cashew chive cream sauce, I think it's called. in this book as well, just because it was wonderful mixed with avocado. So we do a layer of that and then the avocado on top. And Gabriel was getting, I mean, cashews, garlic, lemon, avocado, I mean, all that really great stuff every, you know, almost every morning. He loved that dish.
Lots of good, healthy calories, good, healthy fats. It's a great meal for a little kid.
Okay, another one that caught my eye was the berry chia jam.
I literally had it for breakfast.
Well, I have to try that because I haven't bought a jelly or a jam in forever. And what we like to do is take a dried fruit like apricots or prunes, and now we're using dates, the unsulfured organic kind with nothing on it, of course, and just boil them up with water and mix them, and that's our jam.
Oh, lovely. I know that Dr. Furman has one of those in one of his Feeding Kids book.
Okay. It's just another puree.
Yeah.
I haven't done it with chia, so that's going to be exciting to try.
Yeah, the chia is great because it thickens it and you don't need to add any other thickener, even like the vegan gelatins and stuff like that. It's not always super accessible. And it doesn't add a lot of nutrients, but the chia obviously added omega-3s and omega-6. And we were really excited that, I mean, there's a lot of chia jam recipes out there, but a lot of people still do use white sugar in them, which you could do in a pinch if you only had that. But I was excited. We did this with maple syrup. I've also made it with coconut sugar. You can use what you have, but it's nice because it's not too sweet. You can always add a little sweetener if your kids are used to something sweeter, but unless you add like cups and cups of maple syrup or something, you're not gonna even touch the amount of sugar that you would get in a jelly or a jam at the store. I've tested that recipe out on so many people when I was staying in Santa Cruz, house sitting for my girlfriend. I gave her a jar of it that I made for her when I was leaving. And she called me. She's like, are you coming back to make this for me every week?
Yeah, and we had a tester. We employed, not really, because we didn't pay them. They're wonderful. These volunteer testers, 67, I believe, different volunteer taste testers, parents who tried out our recipes. And our mama, Krista Garvey, who tried that one out, she was like, this is a gem. This is a keeper. I'm doing this one again.
Nice. There are more recipes I want to talk about. But first, I want to bring out a point that you made in the book, which is really important. I don't think a lot of people know this, but I think we all know that refined sugar is not a health promoting food.
Yeah.
But it's okay for a treat. It's okay for special occasions. And it's especially okay when you mix it with fiber. We digest refined sugar a lot better with less havoc when there's fiber with it.
Absolutely.
That's so important. So all your desserts, you made sure that there was a good amount of fiber in them, and that just makes them, I mean, in some cases, it just makes them healthy.
Yeah, it makes such a difference on your whole system. And with little kids, I think about when I was a kid and the things that I ate, you know, generally speaking, I think people just knew less than parents knew less. It's not, I mean, I wonderful parents who were doing a great job raising me, but they didn't know about some of this when it comes to the processed foods. The boom of processed foods, so it happened so quickly. We think of like them, like they've always been around, but it happened so quickly. And then it almost became like a staple, like a thing of the middle class. It's like, if you can afford to have ice cream in your freezer at all times, that means you're doing well as a family.
We trusted those products. We thought they were good.
Absolutely. And I think about like running out to the ice cream truck and not only getting an ice cream, but getting like, I don't want to get like a certain candy brand like in trouble or something. Especially.
That's okay.
I think about like the Fun Dips, and it was like dipping a stick that's made of sugar into a powder that's made of sugar and artificial flavoring, and then licking it off to chase down my ice cream that I ate. Like, what in the world? There ain't no fiber in that. Like, nowhere to be found. And we had no idea. And so the idea that you can feed your children a treat that is truly a treat, you know, a fun thing to enjoy, a cake, a cupcake, a brownie, or blondies we have in the book, or an ice cream pop, or even like frosting that could actually go really well with fruit, or the recipe itself has fiber in it and has all these nutrients in it. I hadn't thought of these things until, you know, I got into this world, but now it's the only way I know how to cook or how to bake.
Yeah, it's true. And it was also very gratifying to see Reed Mangles pull some nutrients out. So she, for almost every recipe, she highlights certain nutrients that I think her threshold was, if it provided 10% or more,
yes,
of the daily value of a certain nutrient, she would talk about it, but not all of them. She didn't do all of them, obviously, but she would talk about in almond flour, you know, even in our goodies, she would pull out, oh, well, this has this much, this is nice. And this has vitamin E, this has thiamine, this has this and that. And it makes you feel good about feeding your kid a treat because it's a whole grain thing with no refined sugar, blah, 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 blah.
The next thing I want to talk about is the subject of beans. Now, I'm nuts about beans. Well, I can't say I'm beans over nuts, but I'm nuts about beans and nuts and all plant foods. But beans are such a nutritious food, full of fiber, a wonderful addition to all foods, including desserts and waffles. You have the white bean wonder waffle, which is a great way to get beans in. Now, I'm curious because in this recipe, you don't cook the beans, you just soak them overnight and then you blend them. I know a lot of beans are different, but I guess that's sufficient enough to make them digestible.
Because you end up cooking the batter, then it's okay.
Marisa, right, you're cooking it in the waffle iron.
That's right. Dr. Mangles is the one who pointed out that raw beans or any kind of, uncooked or unprocessed bean cannot be good for digestion. In fact, you can get sick. Yeah, quite sick. But she said between the soaking and that super, super hot waffle iron, that's going to take care of any dangers. And it has. They're super, super well digested, very kid friendly. They have a mild flavor. They were inspired actually by a recipe in Alicia Silverstone's book, The Kind Diet.
Kind Mama, right?
Kind Mama, that's what it was. The Kind Mama, that's right. And she said, you know, they work great for the freezer if you just want to make them in bulk and throw them in the freezer. And that's what we did. I liked them well enough the way she made them, but kids, I think, wanted something a little bit more familiar. So we added a little bit of milk and a little bit of cinnamon. And so we made it just a little bit more kid friendly. Those are called mommy's waffles. And my kids love mommy's waffles.
Yes.
That's nice. We're a big waffle family. We make a lot of waffles. It's just a fun food.
It is. I mean, you can put your berries on there. You can put your chia jam, right, Laura?
Mm-hmm.
That coconut cream frosting that you have, you could do
that.
Yeah,
the cocoa cream frosting. Mm-hmm. The orangutan approved chocolate hazelnut spread, which is like,
so good.
That's really good on those waffles.
Wonderful. Another recipe, another treat with beans is the PB chickpea blondies. Good. I love chickpeas, garbanzo beans.
Me too. They
are the most magical food on the planet.
They really are. Now what you can do with the water and...
I know. Well, I made a pie crust and I'm making a coconut custard pie with aquafaba meringue. I can't wait.
Oh my gosh.
That sounds incredible. You know, you always get that question, what foods would you bring with you on a desert island? And chickpeas are always on my list.
Yes.
Yeah, you can do everything with them. So you have the chickpea snack?
Yes.
What do you call it? The roasted chickpeas?
Yep, that was from Annika Lindqvist. She's in Sweden, and she's a vegan mom who I met, who was doing a story for Vegan Italy magazine. Mm. And some other magazines, and we connected, and she submitted that. She was craving falafel with her second pregnancy a lot, but she didn't want to go to the trouble of making a bunch of falafel, so she just used falafel-like herbs and roasted her chickpeas, and that's how she invented the herbed chickpeas, roasted chickpeas.
I've never had chickpea milk, but I know some people have had chickpea milk.
Whoa. I haven't had that one yet.
Yeah.
That's next level.
Yeah.
But everything else, I think I've tried. The pâtés, the roasted snacks, and the soca, the crepes. They're just
chickpea flour.
Such a wonderful food. Chickpea flour. We just started buying chickpea flour in bulk.
Really?
Because it's important, in my opinion, to buy organic because of those glyphosate residues that are showing up on all grains and beans.
Yeah.
Even the organic ones. But people say, well, glyphosate is even found in organic products. But I say, well, yes, but the more organic things you buy, then the more organic farms there will be.
That's
and the
less, true.
Less glyphosate overall. So that's why. So, okay. So this hummus may have a little traces of it or whatever, but I'm still going to buy the organic.
Right.
For the reason.
And we have to support that, and we have to use that supply and demand equation. We have to increase the demand so there's more supply, increase the supply, and it becomes more affordable. That's our job.
Yeah,
it is.
And supporting our local farms. When I was up in Santa Cruz just a couple of weeks ago, we made a point to visit a bunch of the local farms, and there was an orchard up there called Andy's Orchard, and we got some of the most incredible produce I've ever had in my life. And I asked if it was, because it didn't say organic. And so I asked if it was sprayed, because I know that a lot of smaller farms can't afford the organic certification, but they don't spray. Mm. And Andy, who owns Andy's Orchard, sadly he wasn't there, but the woman who was selling everything, she gave me a packet. He literally wrote out pages and pages into a packet to explain to people why some people aren't certified and why you should talk to your farmers and see what their practices are and stuff like that. And so I saw also on your website, Karen, that you recently posted something about the Need to Grow documentary.
Yeah.
I sat here and watched that documentary and just cried and cried and cried. It was such a beautiful, empowering film to watch about, like, knowing where your food comes from, growing your own food and all of this, and the importance of organic. Kiss the Ground came out this month as well. We're amplifying the conversation about regenerative farming, organic farming, permaculture. It's really exciting. Some of these words that people didn't know like 5 years ago, and just knowing that we can have such an impact.
We have the solutions.
Yeah.
We just have to put them in place, and we will.
We will. And it's really empowering to know that there's something that we can do as individuals, not that everything should be on us as the individuals, but it's very empowering to know that we can do something between voting with our dollars and the fact that we can grow some of our own food. Those of us who have, even in your kitchen or on a balcony, it makes a difference.
They go hand in hand, right? I mean, laws aren't so much, they don't really push the envelope in terms of public opinion. They're more the thermometer of what's going on. And so they will follow consumers' lead. So if consumers lead in a certain direction and they know that their voters are on board with this or that, then they will follow suit. So we have more power than we often think we do.
We must scream loudly. Let's talk about sprinkles, because I think this is like the highlight, in my opinion. So. Yeah.
I think so too. Kids love sprinkles, and Laura is the sprinkle queen. So I will turn it over to Laura.
Well, it was really great, because I had been working with a different family, because I'm a performer and I'm a theater maker. And I was between acting jobs and things, and I was nannying for a family. And I became super, super close with the youngest in that family, who happened to be born the same day Marisa's oldest, Gabriel, was born. And he would see what I was eating, and it was always very different from what he was eating. And so, of course, he was like around 2 years old when we were hanging out, and he always wanted to eat what I was eating. So I'd be eating like avocados and black beans, and he's like, I don't want this hot dog, I want that, you know? And I was like, okay. Was very happy and to enthusiastically share with him my plant-based food. But one thing that he saw me doing one day was sprinkling hemp seeds on like some bananas and peanut butter. And he asked what that was. And without thinking, I just said sprinkles. And he said, I want sprinkles. Like, okay. So I put the sprinkles on his food, and then he wanted it on everything.
Wow.
And so when I started working with Marisa, and I found out that in her house, they called nutritional yeast sprinkles. And I thought, oh, that's so cool. There's a savory sprinkle. And then, not that hemp seeds are sweet, but hemp seeds could kind of go on anything. So I thought that those would work well on sweet things. And then as we were developing recipes for the book, I was like, what if we had all these different sprinkle recipes, but they were all filled with nutrients? And so we got a nutritional yeast or a Nutri sprinkle in there, but it's a little bit, it's got, you can just use Nutri if you want, but we have this vegan Parmesan that's made with nutritional yeast and cashews. and garlic, and it's absolutely delicious. And you can put it on pastas and soups and salads. We have our Tutti Frutti sprinkle, which has goji berries and chia seeds. We have a sugar and spice sprinkle, which I put on everything, that has a little bit of coconut sugar and flax meal. The hemp sprinkle is the sprinkle that's kind of like our rainbow sprinkle that Marisa, you put coconut with it, right?
Yeah, so yeah. I mixed the hemp seeds with, you know, desiccated coconut, dried coconut, and then you can put food coloring, you know, natural little food coloring in there and just let it dry for a bit, and it'll turn these lovely pastel colors, and just colored little bits of sprinkled whatever it is just make anything a treat. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, half of the fun of getting an ice cream for a kid is getting sprinkles. Right, it's the sprinkles. I remember when I volunteered for the Coalition for Healthy School Foods for a spell, I would do these presentations on the difference between a treat and a snack. But at our house, we kind of blur the line so that we try to make healthy foods into a treat. And so that's what the idea was behind the dessert-y chapter, was making healthy foods something special and feel like a treat. And those sprinkles do help do that.
Mm-hmm. And I love the balance of like, I'm always like, let's make it super healthy. And Marisa's like, remember, kids like this. And so if a kid's not raised on sprinkles made with goji berries, maybe that's not going to be as exciting to them as the hemp rainbow sprinkles that just look like rainbow sprinkles. We cover all of our bases with all of our different sprinkles.
Well, I love your story working with the two-year-old who sees you eating something and wants what you eat, because you talk about that in the book.
Yeah.
The people who eat more vegetables in front of their children eat more vegetables.
That is the bottom line. You know, I get that question all the time. What is your number one tip for encouraging kids to eat healthy? And I always say, kids don't do what you say, they do what you do. And they see what you do. And the bottom line is, all the science points to that as the greatest common denominator, is what your parents eat influences what you eat. It's basically exposure and access. Boils down to exposure and access. Well, how do you get exposure and access? Your parents. So that is the most powerful thing you can do. And even if kids are, you know, a touch choosy, which we know many kids are, including my own, they'll even just know what it is. And we have a rule in our house where they have to try everything that's on their plate. I mean, it could be a granule of a food, but they have to try it. And then they get a little ball in their jar, and then eventually a reward, but it's the consistent exposure over time and their taste buds getting accustomed to it that leads eventually to acceptance.
And occasionally, if you eat something in front of them that you really want them to try and you tell them they can't have it.
That's a good one.
Then they really want it.
Psychology always works.
And also, I've seen this happen a lot where the parent will say to the child, oh, you're not going to like this. And so, because I know you know this, I've read about this in terms of, okay, I don't have any kids, but I read about what happens. And especially when the children are really young, babies and toddlers, when they're about to try something, they look to the mother.
Yes.
And look for that approval. And that's like in our DNA, right? From when we were running around in caves or wherever, the parent knew what was poisonous or not.
Right, yeah. Right.
The parent telegraphs, and maybe not even intentionally.
Right. And also, I think one has to get over one's own, food prejudices and dislikes. I get frustrated with some of the foods that my children don't love. And, you know, that's frustrating. But they also surprise me with things that they love that I didn't like. And so if I had sort of discouraged them from eating zucchini, or she loves asparagus, with copious amounts of nutrients on it, but a little bit of garlic. But she loves foods that I wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole. And if I had, you know, somehow...
When you were a kid, right?
I was a kid. Yeah. Now I love them, obviously. I make them. But yeah, if I had let my own prejudices get in the way, then she wouldn't have, you know, might not have tried and loved the foods. Also, seaweed. They love to snack on seaweed sheets. To this day, I cannot stomach them. I mean, I will do seaweed in a sushi, you know, veggie sushi, but I will not just eat those sushi sheets, those nori sheets, but they love it. And I'm just so glad that they do. But if it had been up to me, you know, and if I hadn't exposed them because, well, you know, they won't like it, then they wouldn't have a wonderful, healthy snack that they love.
Well, how did you know to expose them to that, especially if you weren't eating them?
I'll tell you, I think it was Chloe Jo, my friend Chloe Jo from, well, our friend, Laura knows her too, from Girly Girl Army. She has three boys and her eldest one is older. And she said, oh my gosh, they love these sea snacks or whatever it was. I thought, oh, let me give it a try. And sure enough, they're like crack for kids, for mm-hmm. toddlers. I mean, they just love them.
I love them. I did some engineering work like 20 years ago, almost. I can't believe it's that long, but in Korea. And they ate those as snacks. I mean, that's just a traditional snack food for them. And then it finally came here. And I loved them when I had them there.
I love how international everything is. You know, just things that we considered just off the radar or, you know, not appropriate for children now are just every day and accessible. That's one of the good things of globalization. That's one of the good parts of it.
I enjoyed reading your book and all of the advice, suggestions on how to get through raising a baby, a toddler, young children, to get them to try and eat healthy food. Lots of great stuff. I'm expecting in about 10 years, another book when your kids, Marisa, are teens, because it's going to be a whole other story.
Yes. Yes, it will. And, you know, the way I think about it is, parenting is just one giant exercise in letting go of control, not just when it comes to their food, but like their choices of friends or romantic interests or music or fashion or whatever. You know, you have to, I mean, obviously you have to be a parent, you know, you have to step in when something's dangerous or this and that. But, you know, I keep being reminded that children will push boundaries, and it is like so totally developmentally appropriate for teenagers to push boundaries and to push back. So I am not savoring at all what is to come around food. But, and I do expect maybe some exploration and a little rebellion and this and that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I feel like if they really understand the whys of being vegan and healthy eating, if they're really grounded in that, in the ethics and in the, you know, the health aspect too, although teens tend to feel more invincible than, you know, at their age than a lot of people. But if they're grounded in the morality and the ethics and they have a sense of what's good for their body, when they're young, I say what's safe for your body, then I feel like, you know, they'll be able to navigate that with some aplomb and some confidence. But that's obviously no guarantee. And, you know, nothing in parenting is a guarantee. So I'm, you know, I'm not looking forward to it. But I feel like if you give them the moral compass, then they'll be able to make better choices than if you didn't. That's where I'm at right now. Check back in 10 years and maybe we can have this conversation.
Yes, we'll do that. I'm sure it'll go well. You're giving them a great foundation. But I have to add that I know from personal experience that redheads tend to be more stubborn and more independent.
Oh, I'm in trouble then.
It's like on the same chromosome, stubbornness and red hair.
It certainly seems to be the case so far.
Yeah.
And the environmental aspect also, I think, comes into play a lot more for this new generation than previous generations going vegan or trying to raise their children vegan. Because, I mean, this is such a real thing that's right here and now. And some of these like Gen Z kids, or I don't know, are Emmeline and Gabriel Gen Z?
I don't know what comes after Gen Z,
but these kids are growing up, and you know, I see kids like Genesis or kids like the Earth Guardian kids. And I went to a climate change event in Brooklyn about a year ago, and they had all these Earth Guardian kids there in New York talking about all these different issues and how they're at the forefront of demanding this and that from their communities. And they were all proud vegans, every single one of these kids, and they were making their families go vegan because they were like, hey, this is my planet and this is my future, and you know, we're going to eat this way so that I have, you know, so that I can have children, or so that I can have, you know, an inhabitable planet and everything. And to hear 13, 14, 15, 16 year olds talking like this was so, it just made my heart.
Yeah. Like, exciting, inspiring, so hopeful. Excited.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it was so exciting to bring the kids to the climate change march, which was a year ago this week. And I can't believe it.
It's when the world was different.
I know. And I remember, yeah, bringing them there and showing them Greta, and everybody came to see Greta, and just being able to tell them that she's a, you know, she's another vegan kid, and to know that she's like this environmental rock star. And Gabriel is he's a staunch environmentalist. He's hardcore. He's an animal lover. And I can see him really owning his veganism with pride and defending it as a teen, as a young adult. You know, I really feel like that is, the force is strong with him in terms of veganism. So we'll see.
Excellent. I like ending this time together with you on a hopeful note, with children that are fed not only healthy food, but healthy ideas, things that will lead us into the future, into a better future. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Karen. This has been such a delight. It's been such a treat to be able to talk to you after all these months. We used to run into each other all the time.
I wanted to add, the last time I saw you was when we could go to parties and you mentioned the vegan cookie swap in your book, and how much I love those events, seeing people that I, you know, don't see throughout the year. And then we all come together and we eat cookies and a lot of other good things.
The best day.
And missing the Coalition for Healthy School Foods fundraiser. That's going to be online this year, which that's good. But do I miss those food vendors, right, Laura?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I look forward to that event. That and the cookie swap, two of my favorite events all year.
I guess the last thing I wanted to mention is Laura and I both kind of fell into this play together of how exciting it is for kids to feel like they're changing the planet and protecting animals every day. You know, so many people think that they're afraid that if you're raising your kids vegan, that they'll be missing out or somehow deprived. But it is honestly the biggest gift, because every child loves to think of themselves as a superhero. Mm-hmm. All the movies, all TV shows, it's people with special abilities. Look, I'm praying for the day when veganism is not a special trait and not a special ability, and it's just the mainstream. Even when it's mainstream, they should feel really great knowing that every day, I used to say three times a day with adults, with children, nine times a day, save the planet and save animals and protect their health. And that is just the best gift that you can give them.
Yeah, that was one of our dedications in the book. Marisa dedicated the book to her children. I dedicated the book to my parents. But then together we dedicated the book to parents. As children, they grew up wanting to be superheroes, and now they're the parents of children who can be. And that's so real. That's so very real that those kids have the power to be superheroes right now.
Well, we can tell the children that the world is a scary place and there's a lot of horrible things going on, and we can instill fear and hopelessness in them. Or we can do what Zoe Weil does and make the children solutionaries and empower them and let them know you are going to change this world. You are going to make a difference, and you can and you will. What a difference.
Yeah. I love her. I love her work. And it absolutely is true. When I first came into veganism and this whole world, and I just saw how horrible animal agriculture is for the environment and for animals and for our health, I ended up in a pretty dark place. And kids facing what they're facing now is some dark stuff. I mean, we're facing it. They're going to face it even more. If they are armored with information, if they own their identity as a solutionary, they're going to be equipped with the tools and the resources to do well and thrive. And not just make a difference from the world, but to be mentally healthy while they do it.
A perfect way to wrap this up. Marisa Miller-Wolfson and Laura Delhauer, thank you for joining me today. Thank you for putting together the Vegucated Family Table. I want to just take a moment and dedicate this program to Asher Winter O'Hayan Gordon, who was born just a few days ago on September 29th, and I am going to send him a copy of your book.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Thanks again. And I hope to see you both soon in safety.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Yes. Thanks.
Everybody have a delicious week.